Welcome to episode 159 of Behind the Mission, a show that sparks conversations with Sacramento trusted partners and educational experts. My name is Dwayne France, and each week I'll be having conversations with podcast guests that will equip you with tools and resources to effectively engage with and support military service members, veterans, and their families. You can find the show on all of the podcast players by going to sacramento.org/podcast. Thanks again for joining us in Behind the Mission. Our work and mission are supported by generous partnerships and sponsors who also believe that education changes lives. Our sponsor this week is PsychArmor, the premier education and learning ecosystem specializing in military culture content. PsychArmor offers an online e-learning laboratory that's free to individual learners, as well as custom training options for organizations. On today's episode, we're releasing a previously recorded conversation I had with journalist Sebastian Younger, an author of a number of books, including Tribe and War. This conversation was recorded and released as an episode of the Headspace and Timing podcast in 2019 and is reused here by permission. If you don't know who Sebastian Younger is, he has covered major international news stories around the world and has received both a National Magazine Award and a Peabody Award. Younger is also a documentary filmmaker whose debut film Restrepo, a feature-length documentary co-directed with Tim Hetherington, was nominated for an Academy Award and won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. This episode is slightly longer than a typical Behind the Mission episode, but hang in there because I think it's worth it to hear the insights of someone who has done a lot of thinking about the importance of connectedness and belonging in the military-affiliated community. So here's my conversation with Sebastian Younger. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show to talk. As you probably hear very often, the work that you've done, not just with Tribe most recently, but with Restrepo and things like that, is very well respected in the veteran community. Just having the opportunity to come on and share your thoughts about sort of mental health and mental wellness, it's really appreciated.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for saying that.
So I'd like to really start with Tribe, right? A lot of veterans, I as a mental health professional, I have my clients read it. It really rings true to a lot of veterans. Is that something that you've heard?
Yeah, I have heard that quite a bit, actually, and more. It's interesting that the book did pretty well when it came out, but it wasn't earth-shattering in its performance. But then since then, it just has quietly kept seeping into the culture, including into military culture, I think. But even more broadly with civilians, like people are reading it more and more. And I think for most people, it resonates pretty deeply.
And for you, being that bridge, being the one that takes the stories back, obviously as a journalist, that's what you did and what you do. And not being a veteran yourself, I'd actually had a colleague of mine is interested. How did you get into the Tribe of Veterans, even going as far back as the Coringall and things like that? But how did someone who had never served be someone who is accepted so much in the veteran community?
I'm a journalist, and that job requires that you gain entry into other people's worlds. It's not just soldiers. So if you're going to do something about firemen, you have to do that with firemen. If you're going to cover the Civil War in Sierra Leone, as I did in 2000s, and you're going to cover the combat, you're going to have to manage to attach yourself to militia groups that were fighting that war. That's just what journalism is. Humans are human. Soldiers are human. You're the new kid in school at first, and then eventually they get to know you. And there's nothing unique about being a journalist with soldiers. It's the same problem that any newcomer in a group with a high solidarity, it's the problem that any newcomer has in a situation like that.
Right. And that high solidarity is a barrier to many. As you said, if civilians or those who haven't served are reading Tribe, it's a look into the mindset, the solidarity mindset of the veteran and military community.
Yeah. And I think as far as being covering combat, once you show that you're a decent person, that you're likable, that you're going to be fair in your work, I think most soldiers will are pretty nice to most journalists and willing to open up to them. And as far as veterans and civilians, I think in some ways there are profound differences between veterans and civilians, but there are far more similarities. And I think there is a sort of, in some ways, a false construct of you could never understand what I went through, and or a civilian saying, I can't imagine what you went through, saying that to a veteran. I mean, actually, you can imagine it. There is a basis for trying to imagine an experience. I have a 2-year-old. I'll never know what it's like to give birth. But you know what? I can come pretty close to imagining it in some ways, because there's great communication often between men and women around the topic of birth, right? As there should be. But likewise, if veterans and civilians talk and listen to each other, I think you can get 95% of the way there in terms of understanding the experience and the concerns of the other group. And that part of my work with Restrepo and with WAR and with Thrive is to actually try to facilitate that conversation. But it has to go in both directions, actually. I would love to hear a veteran say, you know, I can't imagine what it's like to be a civilian. I'd like to hear more from you about what that's like. I'd love to hear that question as well.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't go both ways. And I agree, the idea of the gap, if everybody sits on their respective sides and don't actually, you know, reach into that gap, then they're never going to get that. This idea about being a facilitator in between, in my experience as a veteran and as a mental health professional, veterans want their stories told. There's this paradox that we experience is we really want people to understand what we went through. And at the same time, we don't know how to, or somebody's not going to be able to drag it out of us with a team of horses. And that's another thing that I get that you facilitate, is allowing veterans to tell their story in a safe and easy way.
That's a societal problem, and it's not just with veterans. I mean, I think we live in a very complex modern society, and all of us depend on the hard and sometimes dangerous work of groups of other people that we'll never know. We all drive cars. The people that drill oil out of the ground are doing something incredibly nasty and dangerous. I don't know any oil workers, right? I live in a house made of wood. I don't know any loggers. And that's true for most people. And so I think, and veterans, I think, are the most extreme and visible example of that gap. But, you know, we live in a society where all the people we depend on, rely on, we know for the physical nature of our existence, for our physical lives, for our safety, for our comfort, all those people rely on in those industries, we don't know any of them. And most people don't know any of those people. So I think there's a societal problem of communication. And in a simpler tribal society, of course, you would know the buffalo hunter, you would know the guy that tans hides, you would know the whatever, all those micro industries within a small scale tribal society, all those people would be known by everybody and valued by everybody. That's not the case for us. So back to your question, like, how do you facilitate a conversation between groups of people? My idea, which is in my book Tribe, is that you have something called the Veterans Town Hall, where every Veterans Day, have the parade or don't have the parade, it doesn't really matter in some ways, but definitely open up the door of the town hall, the city hall, turn on the PA system. And my proposal is, and we've done this, and it works very well, is to have any veteran, an invitation of any veteran of any war has the right to speak for 10 minutes to the citizenry that hopefully will gather to hear them. And that's a very powerful, extremely powerful and affecting experience, I think, for veterans and for the audience as well.
I like how you bring up this idea of isolation from those that support us. And I had another guest on the show. The military is not about killing and destroying things, about preserve and protect. And overseas, of course, law enforcement. But in America, right, in the United States, there is a mental health crisis. And two of the largest epidemics of suicide are happening in the construction workers and farmers. Again, both sorts of industries that provide support for the rest of the nation, but are extremely isolated. Does that get to this sense of a lack of tribalism leads to isolation and marginalization?
Yeah, I didn't know that about construction workers and farmers. The construction workers, my experience with them is that they work in a pretty tight group. Farming, that's an isolating, that's a very isolated kind of work, I think. Like, dentistry also has very high suicide rates. It's very solitary. There isn't a lot of group dynamic, group interaction, which is something that's extremely healthy for people. The suicide rate's complicated, and it's determined by an awful lot of factors. It's hard to isolate the one thing that's driving it. But what we do know broadly, and there are plenty of exceptions, but what we do know is that affluence goes up in the society, the suicide rate tends to go up, the depression rate tends to go up, the addiction rates tend to go up. Affluence, that has so many benefits, of course, also brings with it some psychological stresses that are very counterintuitive.
Right. That goes to another concept that you had identified in Tribe, and there's been a lot of discussion, is that the prevalence rates of post-traumatic stress disorder and that which is being supported by the VA, they're very different in disability. But mental health goes beyond just PTSD, but that's what we're focusing on. But this affluence in our society, it brings the separation. And as you said, this idea of depression and anxiety – but also when we were all working together as a team, whether it be in Afghanistan or in a tribal society, there was really no concern about purpose and meaning, right? We all knew what the purpose and meaning was, but the more affluent that I seem to understand, the more affluent we get, the more we have to seek or create purpose and meaning because it's not really there. It's been removed.
Yeah. When you use technology to take care of most of the processes that keep you alive, what you lose is the need to belong to a group. And at a very like simple level, survival in the natural world, a human alone in the natural world dies almost immediately. But we only survive in groups. And I think it's very ingrained in us that if you're not in a group and you're not doing something for that group, your safety, your physical safety is really in question. And your safety, your physical safety, and therefore your emotional safety comes from inclusion in a group and inclusion in a group that you're necessary to. The more necessary you are to that group, the more secure your place is in it. And so when you have someone who's not necessary, right? Someone who's retired, who lost their job, someone who has enough PTSD disability benefits to not have to work, for example, what you're doing is you're basically saying, society doesn't need you. We're good. Just do your own thing. We're good. And in a very ancient, deep human sense, when someone says, we don't need you, you're good. You're not good. That's the opposite of good. That means you're in a lot of danger. And that your survival is in question. Obviously, I think people who are really deeply traumatized and not functional at all need to be supported financially in all kinds of other ways. But I think there's a lot of gray area where people were affected by the war, but they could be functional if they wanted to be, if the state told them that they had to be, like you gotta, we're going to help you, but you got to help us. But, you need to find work. We're going to train you, whatever. That reciprocal arrangement with society where every person puts in, that's incredibly important. You could argue that soldiers did put in and that they've done their duty in this society. That's fine with me. I just think you're not doing the veterans a favor by warehousing them with that. It sounds like you're being nice, but actually I think you're doing something that's very dangerous to anyone's mental health.
Right. And that's where I have these conversations a lot with the veterans I work with. Not all of the veterans that I see as a mental health counselor have PTSD, just because it doesn't have the prevalence rate that many people think it does. But nearly all of them are struggling with meaning and purpose. And having that conversation with a veteran who's 27 years old, who has all their basic needs met monetarily, safety-wise, they've got a house and things. And then it's, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? What are you going to do for the next 40 years? Is it sit home and watch TV? And exactly like you said. And then that causes veterans, I believe, to then look back to combat as the best thing in their lives. And I wish I could go back. And they're just on the shelf waiting for another war.
Absolutely. Would you want to create a sort of depressed alcoholic or a depressed non-functional person, give them enough money to survive so they don't have to work, but no tasks and duties to perform where they can feel valued as necessary, and walk away? And of course, those people are going to become depressed, right? Of course they are. And then the depression gets called PTSD. So now you've got a word for it. And in that way, people are, I think, unfortunately, perversely, people are sort of incentivized to see themselves as broken. First of all, they're depressed, but their depression is a very healthy reaction to the circumstances they're in. And then secondly, there is a financial incentive and also a sort of personal incentive. PTSD means you've been in combat. It means you've served honorably. It means you've sacrificed for this country. It means all of these things that society values. And so there's a lot of perverse incentives to actually remain, quote, broken. But I think what society has to do, veterans have to do, is look to, it's an amazing painting. I think it's a real sort of paradigm for a healthy relationship with society, one that we could do for every, not just veterans, for everybody. It's a painting by Lizla Homer. I think it's Lizla Homer. It's called a Veteran in New Fields. And it shows a guy, a young man. It's right after the Civil War, 1865. And it shows a young man with a scythe harvesting wheat. It's like a wheat field of Pennsylvania, maybe something like that. It was clearly a former Union soldier. His gear is piled in one corner of the painting. And he's harvesting wheat. Basically, this guy came home from the war, right? His community said, look, well done on the war. We still need you. We need to get the wheat in. It's fall, right? Here's the scythe. Get to it. And that may seem heartless, but actually I think it's an enormously healthy thing to do, to ask people to continue participating in society. That promotes mental health. Allowing people to not participate in society, I think, in a very, very real sense, leads to depression and even suicide. I think it's an extremely dangerous thing to do.
You know, I really appreciate that. It's a great point. I'm thinking back as you're talking to how veterans reacted to, let's say, coming back from combat. We don't talk about them very often, but World War I, they came back and there was the Lost Generation. Of course, there was the Depression and some really difficult times there, and had not had the sort of the greatest generation vibe that World War II generation had. They came back and went to work, right? Because so many of the, and I've said it before on the show, not just presidents and lawyers and judges and things like, but my grandfathers came back and one became a tailor and one became a mechanic, right? They came back and went to work in their community. Korean War, yes, there was draftees, but it was largely the active military at the time. But then Vietnam, we got to the place where a lot of Vietnam veterans came back and felt this disenfranchisement. Does that pattern seem to hold true?
Yeah, I think in a traditional tribal society, there isn't even a question of whether the returning warriors are going to go back to work or not. Of course they are, right? It's not even a question. And in this society, the wartime generations that were able to come back and go back to work, I think we're very fortunate. And the ones that didn't, and I'm including the current generation of veterans, for economic reasons or social reasons, there is now a sort of like in our society an idea the veterans are broken and they serve their country and they shouldn't have to serve their country any longer. And here's a disability check for the nation, $3,200 a month isn't a lot of money, right? We can afford to sort of warehouse these people and take care of them and forget about them. I think it's terrible for the veterans that are getting these payments, unless, except for the ones that are really, truly are psychologically broken and really need that support. But I think a lot of them could work their way out of it. PTSD, for 80% of people, PTSD is a condition that resolves itself over time. I've had it. Most people in their lives will be traumatized and will eventually get over it. The idea that it's like a permanent state, psychological state for the rest of your life is for 80% of humans, that's not true. And we don't want to incentivize people to think it is true. It's bad for them. And there's an interesting statistic. After 9/11, I live in New York City, and after 9/11, the suicide rate went down in New York City, right? In other words, mental health sort of improved. And the theory was that New Yorkers suddenly felt united. Oh, we're all in this together. And when people feel united, they're psychologically healthier. But another interesting thing is that Vietnam veterans in New York City who were suffering from PTSD said that their symptoms went away. Many of them said their symptoms went away after the attacks. Think about that. It didn't re-traumatize them. It re-energized them. Oh, my country needs me again. We're all in this together. Let's get it done. And so that, to me, is a really revealing statistic about how people respond to crisis and to what degree they really need to be part of the group.
And it goes back to that idea of you're sitting on a shelf or you're in a glass box and break in case of war, and arguably, especially at Ground Zero, and even I heard the same thing in response to the Pentagon in D.C., that take me off the shelf and put me back in the game. And so it's a mixed metaphors. The soldiers have been benched until it's time to hit the game-winning shot at the buzzer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. People are just dying to be needed, to be used. And we are an affluent, mechanized society to such a degree that we actually, you know, don't need everybody in some way. We can afford to carry an enormous number of men and women, like carry them, provide for them, and not require input from them. That's a wealthy society that can afford to do that. You take the Sioux or the Cheyenne or the Apache or whatever before the reservation days. You said, okay, we're going to take some percentage of your young men and young women off the playing field, see how you get along. They'd laugh at you. You're like, we can't survive like that. We need everybody. And that's that's the irony of modern society is our affluence is such a great blessing, but it also comes with these human costs, downsides that often don't get taken into account.
Right. And it's these deeper needs, the need to be connected, the need to be, you know, felt worthy and be a part of society. There's actually an excerpt out of Tribe that I'd like to touch on briefly. You said that humans are so strongly wired to help one another and enjoy such enormous social benefits from doing so that people regularly risk their lives for complete strangers. And when I read that, my thought was, what happens when there's no longer a social benefit to doing that?
Yeah, I think there were, in the case of an emergency, like an emergency on the street, right? Someone's shooting, the building's on fire, whatever it is. I think people that spring into action and help those in danger will always be rewarded in social terms, will be rewarded, will be honored, will be admired. I think that's just so deeply human that it will always be true. But in a more mundane sense, going back to the people we all depend on, the people that drew for oil, the people that cut down the trees, the people that teach our children at schools, these are very basic services that every society needs to make happen. You know, are we really valuing the input of those people? Not really. Sometimes in lip service, we certainly don't compensate them as if we value them. That's for damn sure. You know, capitalism incentivizes other industries and rewards other industries with money and not school teaching. But, you know, really, if you took out all the school teachers, our civilization would be over within a generation. Seriously, think about that. If you just wiped out all teachers within a generation, our society would be over. And they're some of the most poorly paid people in the country. It's insane.
And that's the idea of, and just that sacrifice, because it is a sacrifice. And there is this idea of it's just sort of people working in the background, and this idea of thinking of our soldiers and service members and as they're defending the nation in whatever way and however they're doing that, it's not as visible as the burning car that somebody breaks a window. I mean, it's not as immediate. It's not as aware. The more we're separated from the act of sacrifice, the less meaningful it is.
Yeah, of course, we're humans, and the things that we witness that are near us make depression, and the distant things don't. So there's very good, you know, there's very good human reasons for why guys who drill for oil, it is mostly young men, or it is mostly men, why the guys who drill for oil aren't being recognized and honored by people in New York City. It's so far away. It's like, whatever, you pump the oil out of the gas station, that's how you get it. We don't think about that sort of chain of supply, but we don't do that about anything. And it's the cost we pay for a modern society, and there's a lot of benefits. But we could stop and at least in our mind make a mental experiment of all the stuff I tried on. How did it get here? And who is taking care of me? Wow, all these people. In these industries, I should say, a lot of these industries, logging, oil development, all these commercial fishing, these industries have mortality rates comparable to combat units. Maybe not frontline combat units, but whatever, military units in a war zone, like absolutely comparable. And don't think about it.
And of course, whether we're the genies out of the bottle and trying to create the whole getting back to a tribal society, it's highly unlikely. But your efforts are at least to highlight how this is impacting our returning veterans. It's a thesis on, it's not just PTSD, it's something more than just PTSD. And we as a nation have a responsibility to, one, be aware of it, and then do what we can to address it. And at least for veterans, it's that idea of the town hall.
The thing about PTSD is, like, only something like 10% of the U.S. military is like actively engaged in combat and in a position to be repeatedly traumatized. But an enormous number of people are vulnerable to depression when they come home, right? 1/4 of Peace Corps volunteers really struggle with depression when they come back to this country. And what we have to do is remove psychological stress from trauma. If you take someone who's in a support unit and they really truly are struggling with depression when they get back to this country, what you don't want to do is try to convince them they have PTSD, because that's the only word you have for a veteran who's struggling, right? You really don't want to do that, because they're going to have to invent or reimagine some incident that actually wasn't that traumatic. And they're going to have to reimagine it as a central traumatizing moment in their life, but it actually wasn't. Don't make these people exaggerate. If you had another term for it, like post-deployment transition disorder or something that was actually more honest and applied, and actually applied to the majority of veterans, non-combat veterans, if you had a term like that, it would let everyone off the hook. Okay, you really are struggling. You just weren't in combat. But you don't need to have been in combat to be struggling with the transition from a close, very tightly bonded unit that you functioned with for a year, shoulder to shoulder, doing everything together. That's a deeply human experience. And then you're going from that to now you're living in a single family home in a cul-de-sac outside St. Louis, and you're struggling with that. Of course you are, right? You don't need the trauma. That is totally explained. That change in circumstances easily explains depression. And so I think there needs to be a paradigm shift in the therapeutic community about sorting out what really, not exaggerating trauma when there's another explanation that easily explains some of the struggles that veterans go through who actually weren't getting shot at.
And that's a great point, this idea of, whether you're exposed to trauma or not, but it goes beyond, just PTSD or TBI. And you gave the example of the Peace Corps volunteers, and it put me in mind of Michael Phelps several years ago discussed how severely depressed and literally suicidal he was after, I think it was the Rio Olympics. We just recently had Kelly Caitlin, who is a medal-winning Olympian, 23 years old, took her own life. What you're talking about is this extremely close-knit a group of individuals working towards a common goal. Professional athletes feel the same way when they leave what they're doing. And there are similarities, and neither Olympians nor professional athletes arguably experience the trauma that veterans have, but still have the same non-PTSD challenges.
Oh, it's a terrible problem, I know, with the NFL. I've talked to them about it, how people retiring out of the sport. I'll go you one better. I talked to a young woman after I came talk. This young woman came up to me and she said that she was a cancer survivor and that she'd spent quite a long time on a cancer ward with other people who had cancer, and she was one of the lucky ones. She survived. And she gave me the saddest look, and she said, "Now I miss being sick," which she missed the community of those people, and half of them were going to die. And she didn't know if she was going to be one of them. She still missed it. Yeah, people need community. And when you take someone out of a platoon, maybe they're in a support unit. Maybe they never got shot at. Nothing happened, right? But you take them out of that platoon and you put them back down to society, they're gonna struggle. They're humans. We're wired to be with others. And once we've been exposed to that, and then it's taken away, it's very hard to maintain a psychological health, I think.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I know this is something that you talk about very often and definitely could talk about all day. I definitely want to be respectful of your time. But any last thoughts you think you'd like to leave to the listeners?
Yeah, I think this conversation about mental health and veterans and suicide and all that is very important. But what I would say is that it's not just veterans. These issues apply to everybody. You don't have to have been deployed to be struggling from the exact same thing that veterans struggle with. We all live in an alienated society. You can see the cost in psychological terms. You can see the cost in every direction that you look, and the suicide rate, the addiction rate, the depression rate, the PTSD rates, for that matter, are very high in affluent societies and much lower in poor societies. And we can see this everywhere, and it affects everyone. And what I would say is that on an individual level, if you proactively try to establish healthy group dynamics in your neighborhood, for example, your tribe or the people that live around you. And that's just, we're just stuck with that, right? Actively try to establish healthy, like rich, ongoing daily relationships with people around you where you feel needed, they need you. And also at the sort of macro scale, I think, and I know this is a hot button issue, but I'm going to say it anyway, whether you're Democrat or Republican, the partisan divide in this country is, on a macro scale, another example of this splitting off of people from each other. And it really, it's a threat to our country. Al-Qaeda is not a threat to our country. ISIS is not. They really can't touch us, essentially, in a meaningful way that would take down the country. But we could take down our own country with this nonsense that's going on. And I think for veterans, for everybody, if you really want to talk about tribe and community, it goes all the way from your street corner all the way on up to the White House and Congress. And we have to work on all of that to live in a better society, and we deserve that.
I definitely agree with you. We have met the enemy and he is us, right? I really appreciate you taking the time, a very busy schedule as is absolutely warranted. And just, you probably hear it fairly often, but from one veteran to you and the work that you've done, I really appreciate it. It's used by me as a mental health professional to help open the aperture of some of the veterans' eyes to say, look, you need to go find your tribe. You need to be connected to something. Thanks not just for coming on the show today, but also for the work you're doing. It's greatly appreciated.
I really enjoy talking to you, and thank you for your work with veterans. It's all super important, and eventually we'll all get there, but that's because of good people like you. So thank you.
Once again, we would like to thank this week's sponsor, PsychArmor. PsychArmor is the premier education and learning ecosystem specializing in military culture content. PsychArmor offers an online e-learning laboratory that's free to individual learners, as well as custom training options for organizations. I'm glad to have been able to share this conversation with you. Again, a bit longer than typical, so not as much of a reflection and wrap-up as we normally do. One thing I do want to say, however, is that some might interpret Sebastian's opinions on disability compensation as meaning that veterans should not receive disability compensation or that it should be reduced. First, of course, is that the opinions of the guests are their own and do not reflect me as the host or anyone. But second, I believe his point about disability compensation is secondary to the need for veterans to continue to be productive members of society, and it's more important for veterans to be engaged in their community than separate from their community. In the show notes, I link an article I wrote shortly after this conversation, which is a reflection on the Winslow Homer painting he referenced. Perhaps this conversation can spark some conversations that you might have with service members and veterans. So I hope you appreciated this episode. If you did, we'd appreciate hearing from you. So drop a review in your podcast player of choice or send us an email at info@psychArmor.org. We're always glad to hear from listeners, both feedback on the show and suggestions for future guests. For this week's PsychArmor Resource of the Week, I'd like to share the PsychArmor course, Making Connections and Networking. Regardless of your military background or previous work experience, this course helps service members, veterans, and their families learn how to network in their new communities. You can find a link to the resource in our show notes. So thanks again for taking the time to listen to this episode. Make sure to take a look at the show notes, which you can find in the podcast app, as well as on the PsychArmor website at psychArmor.org/podcast. While you're there, you can find hundreds of online training videos delivered by nationally recognized subject matter experts who are all committed to educating the non-military community about military culture. All of these courses are free to individual learners. You wouldn't be listening if you didn't care, and it's that curiosity and passion for supporting service members, veterans, and their families that we want to encourage and increase. Come back each week for another conversation, and make sure to engage with PsychArmor on social media to let us know what you thought about the show. I'd like to express special thanks to Operation Encore and Navy Seahawk pilot Jerry Maniscalco for our theme song, Don't Kill the Messenger. This show was produced by Headspace and Timing, and all rights to the show remain reserved by PsychArmor. Much appreciation to the team at PsychArmor that makes this show happen. Carol Turner, Vice President of Strategic Communications, who keeps me on track and is an outstanding guest coordinator, and support and transcript by Emma Atherall. Feel free to share the show. In fact, we request that you do, but make sure to let folks know where you heard it. Join us next time for another great episode, and until then, stay aware, get educated, and be well.